Well, good morning. Good to be with you here this morning as we've gathered to worship together. Pastor Phil, our lead pastor, is on vacation, so we trust that he and his family have a relaxing and refreshing time away. He'll be back in the office later in the week. And then if we haven't had a chance to meet, I'm John Nixon. I'm the next-gen pastor here at North Park, and excited to open up the scriptures with you this morning. We'll continue our summer series, Encounters with Jesus, where we're examining different people who had an encounter with Jesus through the book of Luke. Let's just pretend today, let's just say it's really hot. Or maybe hotter. Let's pretend we're in a desert. We've been hiking for hours and hours and our water supply has run out. We're starting to realize if we don't get some water pretty soon, things aren't going to end well. And then off in the distance, we see a building. Looks like some type of cabin or structure. And so there's hope that maybe there'll be some water there. And so we come to the cabin and we look and it's got an old well where at the pump that you have to use. And so you begin to frantically pump to see if any water is going to come out. And all you get is dust. And then you notice that there's a tin can hanging on the pump and it's got a little note in it. And the note says, "Dear stranger, this pump is all right as of June 1932. I put a sucker washer in it, and it should last for quite a few years, but the washer dries out, and the pump needs to be primed. Under the white rock, I buried a jar of water out of the sun and corked up. There's enough water in it to prime the pump, but not if you drink some first. Pour about a quarter of the water into the pump and let her soak for a minute to wet the leather washer. Then pour the rest medium fast and pump hard. You'll get water. Have faith. This well has never run dry. And then when you get watered up, fill the bottle, put it back the way you found it for the next stranger who comes this way." Signed, Pete. What are you going to do? Can you trust that note to possibly waste that water to get nothing? What would make it hard to decide whether you could trust the note or not? A couple of things, right? You don't know who Pete is. It's an anonymous note to you. You're a stranger. So you don't know if you can trust this person or not. You don't know if the note is trustworthy. And there's other areas of our life where this issue of trust comes in. I was just talking to one of our students this Wednesday at our summer breakaway. She had gone to the library looking for a book. And I asked her, "Did you get a book?" And she said, "No, and it's always so hard to know what books might be good or might not be good." And we talked about how, yeah, really it helps if you get a recommendation from a friend that you trust, right? To say, "This is a good book." We like to do the same thing for movies or maybe a restaurant. Part of what social media has provided for us is instant feedback as people rate different restaurants and areas of entertainment for us. We want somebody that we trust to be able to tell us whether this is a good idea or not. Well, we want a doctor. We want a doctor we can trust, and so we ask around when we need a new doctor. "Hey, what have you heard about him? What's his record? Is this a doctor I can trust?" If we're looking for a babysitter, we'd like someone that we could trust, someone who's not going to invite their boyfriend over right after we leave, someone who's going to follow our instructions, someone that we feel we can trust our kids with. This idea of trust is a part of our life in so many different ways. And really what we're asking is this person trustworthy? And as we look at this encounter with the Roman soldier that he has with Jesus, underlying that is this issue of trust. And we're going to be faced with that question. Do we trust God? And do we trust God with our life? So let's open up to Luke chapter 7. Luke chapter 7. If you're not familiar with the Bible, right, the Bible's divided in half, the Old Testament, New Testament. You've got four Gospels at the beginning, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. These are records of Jesus' life and his teachings written from different perspectives based on the author. And we're going to be in Luke chapter 7, looking at verses 1 through 10. If you're a note taker, there's an insert in our bulletin where you can do that. But also on the flip side is a reading plan. And we've been encouraging you guys to read through the book of Luke as we go. We really just believe that the word of God will change your life. And we need these times where we gather together to be taught. But we also need to read it for ourselves. And so there's a reading plan. And if you can't keep up with it, that's okay. Just read what you can. But there's also some questions that you can use for those of you that have kids or teenagers, but also as a spouse or just with friends to help you continue to learn as we go through the book of Luke. All right, verse 1 of Luke chapter 7 says, when Jesus had finished saying all this to the people, he returned to Capernaum. Now, when Jesus had finished saying all this, what is all this? I mean, are we talking about like the first part of Luke? Are we talking about all the Gospels? Are we talking about all the Old Testament? No, just previous, Jesus had been walking. And Jesus, at this time in his ministry, he's got people that are following him all the time. They've heard some of his teachings. They begin to hear about some of his miracles. And so he's got a group that's following him. Now, he's got his real disciples, his closest disciples who are truly believers. And then he's got these other groups that follow him. And just previous to this, Jesus had come down from a mountain. At the bottom of that, he stopped and he just started to teach some of the values of his kingdom, to talk about what is really the heart of someone who would be a true follower of Jesus. And what would that look like in their life? And if you're familiar with the Bible, or maybe you've heard of it, we call that the Sermon on the Mount. And so this is just after that. And Jesus has just finished that teaching, and now he goes back to Capernaum. Capernaum had kind of become Jesus' headquarters in the area of Galilee. If we look at the map here, Capernaum was just on the northern shore. Here it says the Lake Galilee, or the Sea of Galilee it was called, that body of water. And this area of Galilee was where Jesus did much of his public ministry. Well, Capernaum kind of became his headquarters. So he would go out into the towns and villages in that surrounding area, and then he would come back to Capernaum. Capernaum was a busy city. It was surrounded by beautiful hills. Here's a modern day picture of Capernaum. And you could see there was a lot of agricultural growing going on there. It was an agricultural center. And there on the water, there was a fishing industry. And Jesus will call some of his disciples right from that area as they'll leave their fishing careers to follow Jesus. So Jesus has gone back to Capernaum. Verse 2, we read that at the time, the highly valued slave of a Roman officer was sick and near to death. So Luke is writing the book of Luke to record how the gospel, the good news about who Jesus is not only for the Jews, but it's also for the Gentiles. And so here he's sharing an account of a Gentile, a Roman soldier. Some of your translations say a centurion, meaning that he was someone who was in command of about 100 soldiers. A centurion. And he had some servants. And apparently one of his servants was not doing well. He was sick and near death. Now there's a parallel account of this in Matthew chapter 8 verses 5 through 13. And there we have some additional information where it says that the servant was in bed. He was paralyzed and he was in terrible pain. So you have this Roman soldier who has this slave who is sick and he's dying. And he wants to do something. Continuing on, it says that the officer had heard about Jesus. Here in Capernaum, again, this was his headquarters. The miracles that Jesus was doing, the ministry that he was having, that word was spreading. And so here's this Roman officer who's got this slave who he really cares about. And he's in bed, he's paralyzed, he's in terrible pain, and he's dying. And he's heard about this Jesus. And he wants to help. So he sent some respected Jewish elders to ask Jesus if he would come and heal his servant. A lot of this is very shocking, especially for the Jews who would have been reading this or watching this. Here you have a Roman soldier who reaches out to Jewish elders to contact Jesus to get help for his servant. It's very shocking that a Roman soldier would have reached out to Jewish elders. Remember, Rome had come in and taken control. They were ruling over Israel, over the Jewish people. And that was not always a good relationship. But it's also a little surprising, too, that the Jewish elders are the ones that he goes to and they'll be the ones that contact Jesus, because the further along that Jesus goes in his ministry, the Jewish elders, the Jewish leaders become angry at Jesus because they believe that he's blaspheming and that he threatens their authority. So you have these two shocking statements here. But the centurion cares for his slave. He's paralyzed. He's in bed. He's in terrible pain. How is he going to get help? And so the centurion says, I've heard about this Jesus. And he asked the elders, will you go and talk to Jesus and ask him to come and heal my slave? Some situations are like that, aren't they? We come to a point where we don't know what else to do but to call out to God and ask for his help. Maybe it is someone who is sick and dying, and the doctors have done all that they can do. Or they're on a treatment plan, but you're not sure if it's going to work. So we call out to Jesus, and we say, I don't know what else to do, but I need your help. Or maybe it's a loved one who has died, maybe young or old. And in that loss, there's a grief that comes that is overwhelming. And not just that immediate grief, but a grief that seems to cycle back around. Just when you think maybe you're making progress and getting past it, a memory comes or something stirs emotions and it comes right back. And you say, I don't know what to do with that. Maybe I should take that to Jesus. Maybe it's a financial devastation that comes unexpectedly. Maybe it's related to a retirement fund or some investments. Maybe it's related to the loss of job. Maybe it's a natural disaster of some sort. But there's nothing that you can do. And you're left with, I'm going to take this to Jesus. Because I feel like God is the only one really that could help me here. Maybe it's a sinful habit that you know is wrong. And you've admitted it's wrong. And you've sought help. And you've repented. And you've committed not to do it again. And to replace that habit with a good habit. But you find yourself committing that same sin again. And the guilt and the regret just comes back again. And it's a cycle that you can't seem to break out of. And you say, I need help. I need to take this to Jesus. Because maybe he's the one that can help me. One of the things that we're told today with all of the social media, that with the studies that are coming on now, more than ever, not just our teenagers, but as adults, we're filled with anxiety and stress for lots of different reasons. But life in itself can bring that kind of anxiety and stress that can just be paralyzing or demoralizing, depressing, and we despair. And maybe in those moments we say, I don't know who to turn to. I don't know what to do. But like the centurion, we say, I'm going to take this to Jesus and see if maybe he can help. There was a playwright named Horace who wrote, a Roman playwright who wrote during the time of Julius Caesar. And he got frustrated with the playwrights because they didn't write very well. And anytime there was a problem to be solved, they just put a Roman god in to solve it. And so here's what he said to his fellow playwrights. He said, do not bring a god into the stage unless the problem is one that deserves a god to solve it. This centurion has realized that the problem that he has needs a god to solve it. And he's heard about this Jesus who claims to be God and who is healing people. And so he talks to the Jewish elders and he says, would you please ask Jesus to come and heal my servant. Verse 4. So they earnestly begged Jesus. Now, doesn't that tell you something about the relationship that this Roman soldier had with these Jewish elders? On his behalf, they go and beg Jesus, would you please come heal this man's servant? Why would they do that? Continuing on. They begged Jesus to help the man because they said, if anyone deserves your help, he does. For he loves the Jewish people and even built a synagogue for us. A Roman soldier loving Jewish people. And so much so that he helped build a synagogue for them. And most of the commentaries that I looked at figured that the centurion must have had enough money that he was fairly well off that it seems to be implied that he actually built, he paid for building this house of worship for the Jewish people. And so there's this love between this Roman soldier and these Jewish elders. And when he asks them to go, they say, we'll do it because this guy deserves it. He loves us and he's helped us build a synagogue. So they feel he's worthy. But how would Jesus respond to this request? Would he go? Would he heal this Gentile's slave? Let's look at verse 6. So Jesus went with them. But just before they arrived at the house, the officer sent some friends to say, "Lord, don't trouble yourself by coming to my home, for I am not worthy of such an honor." So the Jewish elders say, "Man, this guy is a good guy. He loves the Jewish people. Even though he's ruling over us and he can make our life very difficult, he's helped build a synagogue, which is so important for us, a house of worship in our community. He deserves this." And even though the soldier has asked for them to send Jesus, apparently he either begins to think about it or he realizes it may not be a good idea for him to come all the way to his house. He says, "Because I'm not worthy." So from the outside, people looking at his character and what he's doing, they say he's worthy. If anybody should get a response from Jesus, this guy should, because he's worthy. But as he looks at himself in comparison to Jesus and who he thinks Jesus is, he says, "I'm not worthy. I'm not worthy of that." If we were to go back and look at the Sermon on the Mount that Jesus preached, a lot of you are familiar with the Beatitudes, and the first one is, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for the kingdom of God is theirs." That phrase, "poor in spirit," was something that Jesus used to illustrate that those who are humble, those who recognize their need of God, those who have a proper perspective of who they are the ones who will receive the kingdom. They're the ones that Jesus will respond to. And here we see that in this Roman soldier. Now, we don't know if this is saving faith or not, or we don't know if it's a step towards saving faith. But we do know that he has a proper understanding that he really doesn't deserve for Jesus, God's son, to come and heal his servant. And not just because he's a Roman, but because none of us deserve anything good from God. We like to compare ourselves to others and say, "I'm not so bad compared to that person or that person." But all of us, when we compare ourselves to the perfect Son of God, we are not worthy to be in the presence of Jesus. We're not worthy to have Jesus come to our home. And so if we were to use one word to describe this Roman soldier, I would use the word humility. Humility. Now, we might have been thinking that it's really not good for a Jewish person to come to a Gentile home. That would make him unclean. He's not really supposed to do that. But more than that, I think, as you see that he says, "Don't come. I'm not worthy. I'm not even worthy for that kind of honor for you to come and do this." One of the commentators had this statement about the fact that Jesus didn't need to go to his home. He said, "Magical presence or touch is not required for healing, only the power of Jesus' command and will." Now, many of the miracles, Jesus did touch people. In fact, when he healed the leper, he touched the leper, probably the first time that leper had been touched since he had contracted leprosy. There's other times when Jesus mixed a mud type substance and put it on people's eyes. There were different ways that he healed. But what we have here is a recognition by this soldier that Jesus doesn't actually have to come to my house to do anything special to heal my servant. All he has to do is speak it, and it can take place. All that's needed is the power of Jesus' command and his will. Now, how does the centurion know this? Is it just that he's heard about Jesus or knows it by reputation? Well, he knows it by life experience, because he understands that Jesus has authority. And look at verse 8. There he says, "I know this because I'm under the authority of my superior officers and I have authority over my soldiers. I only need to say go and they go. Or come and they come. And if I say this to my slaves, do this, they do it." Right? He was a soldier. And he had people above him and he had people below him. And he was given certain authority. He had to follow orders, and then when he gave orders, he expected them to be followed. You don't have to be a soldier to know this, right? If you work in a job, if you're a part of a team or a club at school, if you're in any kind of organizational structure, there are always people with authority who get to make the rules and tell you what you're supposed to do. And if you're in one of those positions, you get to do that with other people. So he recognizes that Jesus has authority. And all Jesus needs to do is speak. And whatever he says will take place. Now, my dad was in the Army. And so I was born in Dugway Proving Grounds, Utah. And I lived there for all of 7 days. And as soon as I was old enough to get on a plane, we flew to New Mexico where my dad was being stationed. And we moved around quite a bit every couple years. Lived in North Carolina and New York and Okinawa, Japan. And then when he retired, we moved to Florida. But it's interesting growing up in the house of someone who's in the military. They have this crazy idea that whoever is in charge, when they give an order, it should be followed, like immediately. But it's easier to teach a soldier that than a kid. Especially a kid like me who wants to know, why? I know your kids don't do that. Or you never did that to your parents, right? My dad would tell me to do something. It didn't make sense. Dad, why? Why would we do that? Just do it, right? And as I would talk to my dad about the military and why that was so important, he explained it to me. He said, when you get into certain situations or you're in combat and you have somebody who gives you an order and you want to talk about it or delay it, it could cost you your life. So all of that crazy training that you go through in boot camp and your regular routine and your training day in and day out and the idea that you follow orders, whether you understand it, whether you like it, you just follow orders. Because when it comes down to war or difficult situations or dangerous situations, following orders will save lives. That's what this soldier understood. That was his life. That was his training. Whoever's in charge has the authority. And all they have to do is give a command, and it's expected that people will obey. Now, a little lighter area of life, if you have Alexa, she'll obey you most of the time. Right? You guys know what I'm talking about? An Echo Dot of some sort? This artificial intelligence is supposed to recognize our voice and do what we say. So I really wasn't intending to kind of get into that field of our house having little devices that I could talk to and they do certain things for me, but I got one for Christmas from my daughter, Brittany. And then we had to figure it out. So then it was cool. I could play music on it or do certain things. But you have to learn that really it only does what you already own. What I mean by that, you have to have an app or you have to own certain software for that to be a part of that. So we got it. We've seen all the commercials. We just started telling Alexa to do all kinds of things. Hey, play this. Go to this. Do that. Nothing happened. Alexa didn't cooperate at all. So then we started to figure it out. And then I said, well, this would be cool. I've seen where people can talk to Alexa and she'll turn the lights on and off. Now that might be worth looking into. So my kids bought me some of these special light bulbs with a hub for my birthday. We've got it hooked up now. So now I can walk into my living room in the morning and say, Alexa, living room on. And the lights just go. But I also can say, Alexa, turn Larry Bird on, who was my favorite basketball player of all time. So I named the lamps Larry and Bird. But my wife didn't laugh. She doesn't think that's funny. But for the most part, when she hears me correctly and we can get it straight, I command Alexa and she responds. So Josiah, my son, who's 23 years old and he's kind of into computers and technology and all that kind of stuff, he messed with it the other day and he said, Dad, I got you covered now. When you're going to bed, all you have to do is say, Alexa, good night. And the lights go. Whew. So that's me and Alexa, we got a thing going now. I'm usually the last one to bed. Alexa, good night, and the lights go down, right? The idea behind that technology and so many other things that are supposed to make our lives easier is it's on command, right? This soldier was used to a life like that, and he recognizes something unique in Jesus, that Jesus has authority over everything and everybody, including illness, being paralyzed, being close to death. And he sends word to Jesus, don't come to my house, I'm not even worthy of that. But I know if you'll just speak the word, then it'll happen. Usually when people hear Jesus teaching or they see him do these things, they're amazed at him. And this is one of the few times that Jesus is amazed by this person, the centurion. Look at verse 9. When Jesus heard this, he was amazed. What does it take to amaze the Son of God? He was amazed by the faith of this centurion. And he commends him for his faith, and he turned to that crowd. He's always got that crowd that's following him. And some of them are real believers, and some aren't. And some are just trying to see what's in it for them, or is he a fake or not? He turns to that crowd, many who would have been Jewish people. And he says to them, I haven't seen faith like this. Never before have I seen faith like this in all of Israel. And in that, at the same time, he was commending the faith of this Gentile soldier, while at the same time rebuking many of the Jewish people who knew the history of God and history throughout the Old Testament. From the beginning where God created Adam and Eve, and they fell into sin, and God promised a Redeemer, a Messiah, who would be the answer to the sin problem, who would come and make things all right. That Jewish people who should have recognized Jesus, who should have had a faith that this is the Messiah. And he rebukes them because so many of them were unbelieving. And he's pointing out that Jesus will respond to anyone who puts their faith in him, who has faith in who he is and what he can do. It's not just the Jewish people or a special group of people of any kind. God's plan is for people from all over the world to come into saving relationship with him, to be restored back to him. It's not for people who just grew up in one particular denomination or one particular country. God will respond to any person who has the kind of faith that the centurion has. So if we had one word for the centurion, that was humility. One word for Jesus is authority. Jesus has all authority, and here we see him using it for the good of people that he cares about. And what happens? He comes and says, all you have to do is speak it. And Jesus says, wow, I've never before seen faith like this in all in Israel. Verse 10, when they returned back, his officer's friends returned to the house. They found the slave completely healed. Jesus has all authority, completely healed. And the readers of this account, the people who were listening to the audience first, but then the readers of this account, you and I, are supposed to ask this question. Do you trust Jesus the way this centurion did? Do you recognize the authority of who Jesus is and what he's promised to do? If we go back to our quote, magical presence or touch not required for healing, only the power of Jesus' command and his will. Today, maybe it's a loved one who is sick and dying. Maybe it's a loved one lost. Maybe it's a fractured relationship of some sort, a marriage that's falling apart, a relationship with a family member or a friend or a coworker, maybe somebody in the body of Christ and you just can't make it work. Maybe it's a sinful habit that you keep struggling with and going back to, or anxiety and stress that's paralyzing. Today, can you trust Jesus to help you with that? Have you gotten to the point where you recognize you're not worthy of any help from God, but you're willing to ask? And by faith, know that he has the authority to help you. Can you trust him? Is he trustworthy? Maybe you say, you know what, I'm deserving of that, and I've been asking and asking and wanting God to do that, and he hasn't done it, but I deserve that. I've tried to live a good life, or I've been a believer for X many of years, and I've tried to live a good life. Why is God allowing this to happen to me? Why is he not doing for me what he did for this Roman soldier? And those are tough questions that we struggle with, and we have to take a step back and look at these miracles that Jesus does. What's the purpose in the bigger picture of why Jesus does these miracles? Throughout the New Testament and the Gospels, you read that Jesus did these as a sign. He did them so people would know that the kingdom of heaven had arrived in him. But it has not arrived fully. This is like a commercial, if you will. It's a preview of coming attractions, as Stephen Curtis Chapman would say, of what's to come in the future when Jesus will get rid of all sickness and all death and all pain. And he has the authority to do that. But that's not yet. But we make a huge mistake if we believing that Jesus can heal, that he can restore, that he can do these things now, and yet he doesn't. We make a huge mistake if we interpret that as Jesus doesn't care. It's whether he wills to do it at this particular time. Look at Luke chapter 5 and verse 12. This was the leper there. In one of the villages, met a man with advanced case of leprosy. When the man saw Jesus, he bowed with his face to the ground, begging to be healed. And Lord, he said, if you are willing, you can heal. That's the faith that the centurion had. Jesus, if you want to do this, I know you can, because you have authority over everything. So the question is, why does God sometimes heal, and other times, why does he not? If we have a faith that says God has to do what I want him to do at the time that I want to do it, we have a very circumstantial faith, a very fragile faith, because what we're trying to do is interpret our circumstances when we don't have a big enough perspective. So 4th of July, there's probably going to be some parades around. I don't know what the heat, if you'll go out, but when you go to watch a parade, you usually don't start with the beginning of the parade and walk along with the whole parade, right? You usually go camp out a good spot so you can kind of see the parade come by. But if somebody were to ask you, say you're right in the middle of the 4th of July parade, there's a float coming by, and somebody says, hey, describe the parade to me as it is right now. All you can describe is the float right in front of you. But you can't see the whole parade. Maybe you've even seen the beginning of the parade, so you could describe that a little bit, but you don't know what the end of the parade looks like. But if it's in downtown Grand Rapids and I can go up on top of the Amway Grand and I can look down and I can see the parade from beginning to end, I could describe the parade to you. When you and I look at our circumstances and we want God to do something desperately for us and it doesn't seem like he's listening, or we're not getting the result we would expect, it's like us sitting in the middle of the parade just trying to describe what's in front of us. And we don't know fully what already went in front of us, and we don't know what's coming behind us, because our frame of reference is too small. And what a huge mistake it is to conclude God doesn't care, or maybe my faith isn't great enough. Our faith, the kind of faith the centurion had, has to be grounded in a person, the person of Jesus Christ. Because in the end, what Jesus gives us is himself. And we can have faith that he is who he says he is, and that he'll do what he said he would do. And the miracles were simply demonstrations of that, to point to a larger picture. Look at Hebrews chapter 2. Verse 17, it says, it was necessary for him, Jesus, to be made in every respect like us, his brothers and sisters, so that he could be our merciful and faithful, or trustworthy, high priest before God. Then he could offer a sacrifice that would take away the sins of the people, since he himself has gone through suffering and testing. He is able to help us when we are being tested. Wherever you find yourself this morning, can I just encourage you? You pray for a miracle. You pray for a healing. You pray for God to take whatever it is that's in front of you out of your life. And you believe with all your heart God can do that if he wants to. But even when he doesn't, he gave you already Jesus. He gave you himself. And that's enough to trust him when he doesn't remove that obstacle from your life. And to trust him for daily strength to make it through. So we look for trust in entertainment, with how we're going to handle our money, our homes, our kids. But the question this morning is, will you trust God with your life? Because he is trustworthy. I want you to look at this quote that's contained in a book. It says, the other gods were strong, thou wast weak. They rode, but thou didst stumble to a throne. But to our wounds only, God's wounds can speak. And not a god has wounds, but thou alone. That's contained in a book by Tim Keller. It's called Walking with God Through Pain and Suffering. Excellent book, and I would encourage you to pick it up if that's a subject that's interesting to you. And he explained this better than I ever could, so I'm just going to read a couple paragraphs for you here. He says, "We turned from God, but God did not abandon us. Only Christianity of all the world's major religions teaches that God came to earth in Jesus Christ and became subject to suffering and death himself." So what this means, yes, we do not know the reason God allows evil and suffering to continue or why it's so random. But now at least we know what the reason is not. It cannot be that he does not love us. It cannot be that he does not care. He is so committed to our ultimate happiness that he's willing to plunge into the greatest depths of suffering himself. He understands us. He's been there. He assures us that he has a plan to eventually wipe away every tear. Someone might say, but that's only half an answer to the question. Yes, but it's the half that we need. And then he mentions a lady named Ann Voskamp, who wrote a book called 1,000 Gifts. And she shares her journey to understand the senseless death of a sister crushed by a truck at the age of 2. And in the end, she concludes that the primary issue is whether we trust God's character. Is he really loving? Is he really just? Her conclusion, God gave us Jesus. If God didn't withhold from us his very own son, will God withhold anything we need? If trust must be earned, hasn't God unequivocally earned our trust with the bark on the raw wounds, the thorns pressed into his brow, your name on the cracked lips? How will he not also graciously give us all things he deems best and right? He's already given us the incomprehensible. Can God heal? Can God deliver us from whatever it is we're facing? When we say, I hate this, I want this out of my life, God, please take it away. Yes, he absolutely can, and he often does. But we also need to trust him when he doesn't. And we know that he's a perfect father. And so we trust and we love that he'll give us wisdom and joy in the middle of the hardship, and that he'll guide us through it. Because in the end, he gave us himself.